Morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call Senate Finance Committee to order February 5th, 2019. It's Tuesday. I'd like to just remind everybody in the audience, it's probably tired of hearing this, but to mute their cell phones as we go forward through the meeting today. With me today is co-chair Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Bishop, Senator Wilson, Senator Olson, Senator Machicki, Senator Schauer, Senator Wilikowski, myself, Stedman. We have a quorum to do business. We have two things on the agenda today and a little bit of cleanup. We had an item that was scheduled for yesterday, but we ran late, so we moved it till today. Savings accounts and budget reserves, which is our cash balances. And then we're going to have a presentation on negotiated labor contracts. But before we start the first presentation today, I'd like to just highlight to the committee members and interested parties that we have some updated slides on yesterday's presentation from the debt manager, Mr. Mitchell, on a summary. There was a request that he add in the statutory dividend in the cash availability. So those have been done on his slide number 4. And then on the slide on page 12, we did the further look back on CBR and SBR, our savings accounts. For those watching at home, both constitutionally controlled, the constitutional budget reserve, which takes a three-quarter vote, and the statutory budget reserve, which is a simple majority vote. Those two were added to more of historical data to year 2000. We have also had him update the slide on page 20, which deals with the general fund debt service chart and the going back in history to 2000. But I find that particularly one of them is unreadable over that length of time and with a high spike of the $3 billion infusion we had in the presenters. So we'll be asking him to restate those graphs and also add the PERS and TERS payments so we can kind of see, and we'll take a chart and we'll view the PERS and TERS as if it was a standard GO bond or standard debt, so we could take a look at the multitude of our state-supported debt and GO bond debt and municipal, the state side of the municipal debt, along with PERS and TERS, so the committee will get a good feel for the holistic view of our debt service coming at us. I just wanted to highlight that to the committee members that should have hit your inbox this morning. So I'd like to go ahead and start now into the presentation from the Department of Revenue. If we can have representation come forward. We have the Director of the Treasury Division with us. If she can jump in the hot seat. And start by introducing herself, of course, who she represents. Give us a brief history, your work history, and why the committee should pay attention to what you have to say. I think it's going to be very informative along with the public. And I'd like to just make a quick note that Senator Giesel, Senate President, has joined us since the beginning of the meeting here. And we are anxiously awaiting you to tell us we have ample liquidity to make our payroll, do the FY20 budget.
I will do my best, sir.
Okay.
For the record, my name is Pam Leary. I am the director of the Treasury Division. I started my career as an accountant, a CPA at Price Waterhouse. Went up the ranks there. Finished my career as a partner in the combined firm of Price Waterhouse Coopers. I traveled around the world for some time and wound up in Juneau, Alaska. Did a number of different types of jobs until I went back to my roots as an accountant at the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation for a very short time before I was pulled into the Department of Revenue as the comptroller. And in 2014, I became the director. And that's where I am now.
Okay. Thank you.
So today, I'd like to give a brief overview of the Treasury Division and then talk about the key funds, the state's investment funds, including the savings account. The Treasury Division, for those that don't know, provides debt management, and we heard Mr. Mitchell yesterday, cash management, unclaimed property management, in addition to investment and portfolio management services for the five funds we're going to talk about today. And that's the state's general fund, or the JFANSI, the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund, the Public School Trust Fund, the Power Cost Equalization, and the Retirement Funds. We also manage numerous other funds in their investments. The division also provides staff to the Alaska Retirement Management Board, and I may refer to that as the ARM Board, but I'll try not to, and the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank Authority. So we currently have 45 Treasury staff, and I would say about 80% of them touch investments in some capacity, whether it's doing the actual investing or accounting for the investments or ensuring that our investment policies are in compliance, and cash management as well, which allows us to know how much money there is at the end of each day or the beginning of each day for investments. At 12/31, we had 38.8 billion assets in 45 separate accounts that were managed. 14 were in the defined benefit funds under the direction of the Alaska Retirement Management Board. There were four participant-directed funds, which are the defined contribution plans, the supplemental benefits, and the deferred compensation funds, also under the fiduciary of the ARM Board. And we had 25 funds under the direction of the Commissioner of Revenue. Two funds we have for other state fiduciaries, that's EVOS and Mental Health Trust. The accounts are managed in a pooled environment, which is an efficient way to manage investments, and they're like building blocks, pools. You can invest in 20% of one pool, 30% of another. It's just an easy way to allocate funds. For state assets, there are six pools that funds can invest in, and for the ARM Board assets, there are 23 investment pools, and those roll up to six asset classes that the retirement funds, the defined benefit plans, can invest in.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're always looking for efficiencies. Why not let the permanent fund corporation manage these assets?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski. Each of the funds that are managed have specific time horizons and risk challenges or appetites, and it requires separate allocations for certain funds. My understanding is that the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, or my knowledge, is that they have one asset allocation, and that is what they that might not be an appropriate asset allocation for some of the funds that are managed at the state treasury.
Go ahead and continue. We have a question from Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So the statistics you gave initially, that was actually very useful. I tried to capture some of that. Is there a way, because I didn't see it, of course, on a slide, that you could kind of provide, you know, the 45 funds, this several of them are pooled environment, 25 funds of the Commissioner of Revenue. Just you can we have a list of the funds? Can you kind of provide us something of everything you just said?
If you could come back to the committee with a list of your assets under management and the categorization of them.
Through the chair, I'd be more than happy to. And we also have our website identifies all of these funds and how they're in the pool structure, but I'd be happy just to send over a list that summarizes everything for you in that way.
Yes, thank you. Go ahead and continue.
Mr. Chairman.
Wait a second here. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Leary, the other thing I'd like is the rate of return or what kind of investment outcomes you've had on them. And since Senator Wilikowski brought it up, how they compare with a permanent fund board.
Sure. Through the chair, I'd be happy, Senator Olson, to provide that information. And we'll have some of that information in the slide pack today, some of the key funds. But that is easily provided.
Okay, go ahead and continue.
So just in terms of process, I know you had a presentation by the Permanent Fund Corporation. So I'm not going to go through a detailed process, but there is a similar function in that annually or as needed. For the state assets, for example, the Commissioner of Revenue, as fiduciary, will sit down with our Chief Investment Officer as well as our staff, and they will determine asset allocations for each fund. And so a lot of work has already occurred upon the time that they start sitting down to discuss this. And consideration is given to the type of and use of the fund, how long the fund is expected to be invested, and what type of risk each fund can take. We also use the Callan Consultants' capital markets assumptions to develop some of the asset allocation possibilities that are discussed with the fiduciaries. And this is the same process that we use with the Alaska Retirement Management Board. Generally in June of each year, that is when the annual asset allocation is adopted. But again, asset allocations can change depending upon circumstances and the fiduciary's desire.
Could you lower your mic a little bit? Just pull it down. There you go.
I'll try not to hit it. So, we'll go on to slides. So, the Jafonzi. I'm sure some of you have heard this term and have no idea what it means. It's the general fund and other non-segregated investments. So the general investment fund was created around statehood, and it held the cash and investments of the government funds. As more and more funds were added through legislature, it became somewhat necessary to separate them out into separate accounts. And so in 1992, the Jafonzi pool was created, and it's a way of investing all of these smaller funds together along with the general fund proper. And the general fund proper is what I refer to as our operating account. That's where all the money comes in and out of the state. The Department of Administration and their Division of Finance separately account for each of the funds within the state accounting system, and the Department of Revenue at the Treasury is responsible for investing the Jafonzi and calculating and allocating daily investment earnings to each of the funds. There are 180 funds. Some are categorized type 1, type 2, or type 3, and that's just a naming structure. The type 1 assets are those that are given their earnings by statute or other law. And type 2 and type 3 generally are not getting their earnings. Type 3 never get their earnings. Type 2 may get their earnings if the legislature so chooses in any given year to appropriate them. In 2018, we actually took a portion of the funds of the Jafonzi, and we created a Jafonzi 2, we call it. And the funds that are in the Jafonzi 2 are those that are type 2 and type 3 that don't get their earnings. And it was a mechanism by which we were able to increase the target rate of return and risk allocation for those assets that do not get their earnings. So there was less risk to those assets. I'll go to slide 3 so you can see kind of the statistics of each of the Jafonzi 1 and Jafonzi 2 assets. So you can see we have the investment objective, the target asset allocation, the market value, and the returns as of December 31st. The Jafonzi 1 has a short to intermediate investment horizon with moderate risk and has a target allocation that has primarily shorter term fixed income assets. The Jafonzi 2 has a moderately high risk appetite, and it is invested with an intermediate horizon. So there are longer assets in this fund. If you can see in the pie chart that there is also some equity and international equity as part of the Jafonzi 2 investment allocation. If you jump down to the bottom where we see Callan projected 10-year returns, again, we use the 10-year market assumptions that Callan provides. And based on the asset allocations that are being used, we develop a return target. So this is essentially what we would expect over a 10-year period these funds to achieve on average for the 10 years. Back up to the market value, you can see combined is $3.2 billion of funds, and about 56% are in Jafonzi 1, and the rest are in Jafonzi 2. The one-year actual return as of 12/31, which is a one-year rolling return, is 1.86% for the Jafonzi 1. And because Jafonzi 2 is so new, we do not have a corresponding return rate there, but you can look up to the three-month and the six-month, and you can see how, due to the volatility in the last few months, the target allocation, or I'm sorry, the actual return was lower in Jafonzi 2 than Jafonzi 1, and in fact, it was negative over the last 3 months ending December 31st. So I thought I would pause here and just mention the fact that in my slides, the statutory budget reserve, I have put into.
If we could, we'll go ahead and finish
the general fund. So I didn't know if you wanted to have a conversation about the statutory budget reserve and its values or not, but just for purposes of looking at it, as part of the Jafonzi funds, it originally was part of the Jafonzi funds. For a short time, it was separated out as a separate account. As it grew and had its separate asset allocation, but it has rolled back into, I think as of 2015, into the Jafonzi, and that's where it sits. Just a point of interest.
Okay. Back on, are you done with slide three?
I am.
Okay, so on slide three, I have a couple questions.
Okay.
How do you invest in the international equities and domestic equities? Is that through index funds, or do you have traders sitting there? Or can you explain to the committee how that process works?
Sure. As I mentioned at the start of my presentation, we have these pools, and one of the pools is a domestic equity pool, and that is, in fact, a passive index fund that is managed by one of our managers, SSGA. In the international equity, we have a mixture of both passive and active managers. We have one active manager.
So for those at home, can you tell us what a passive index or passive fund is, passive investment fund? What are you talking about?
Sure. So often you will see on the news what the market is doing. And a passive investment fund is a fund that targets basically the market. It tries to follow the market rather than taking bets, which are considered active management, on different types of investments and how they'll go. And another way to think of a passive investment is when you look in the return boxes, there's something called a benchmark, and those are in fact the passive investments of the marketplace. And so when we create an asset allocation, we come up with a benchmark that approximates what we're investing our assets to, and that's what we compare ourselves to when we invest.
Okay, and then on your the lower part of your slide, you're talking about three-month and six-month returns. Are those annualized or year-to-date, or what are those returns?
Those are just for the three-month period.
You know, it says actual, 0.81, 1.26 for 6 months?
Yes, correct. Those are the six-month returns.
For just 6 months, it's not annualized?
No. And so you can see the one-year actuals. That is an annualized, it's a rolling number, so it's at a particular point in time.
Right, and just for those watching at home, you don't annualize less than a year of returns because you get distorted numbers. So those are just basically year-to-date. Any questions on slide three before we go to slide four? Seeing none, if you could continue on then, please.
Sure. Chair Sidman, would it be appropriate to give a discussion about the general fund proper right now, since we're on the slide, since you wanted to talk about liquidity? And the general fund proper is where it's the operating account that does require money coming in to pay the assets?
That would be fine.
Okay, I don't have a slide for that. That's why I thought it might be a good discussion point, because I know that's of interest to you. The general fund right now has a balance just under $400 million. We do have on our website also, you can actually track what our forecast is of what we expect our general fund to be. It is where the money comes into and out of the state to pay salaries. If we get federal receipts, it comes through, it gets cleared, it goes to the appropriate agencies, et cetera. We have been working with declining revenues, and also revenues come in at different times than our expenditures are required, and so that requires some borrowing. And in the past, the borrowing sources has been both the statutory budget reserve as well as the constitutional budget reserve. And with the passage of SB 26, that now includes the earnings reserve from the Permanent Fund Corporation. And so in terms of funding the cash shortfalls this year, we took $700 million, I should say borrowed, because we borrowed $700 million, from the constitutional budget reserve. And we have taken $350 million in October from the earnings reserve, $250 million in December, and we're anticipating in February and April additional amounts to be taken, each of $250 million.
So you're somewhere at $1.4 billion?
$1.1 billion from the earnings reserve.
In total?
That's what we will expect to take through April. And that will leave a balance. And I would also say that the cash management tools that we use, we have a model, and it's based on assumptions. It's based on what we think we're going to pay out based on past years, large expenditures like for education that we know are coming up. And we have to be very nimble with our model, because in some months, especially recently, we thought we were going to have more oil revenue coming in than we did. And so we've had to make some changes, and we've been working with the Permanent Fund Corporation to ask for more or less depending upon what our needs are expected to be. And this is primarily in keeping with the intent language that the legislature put into the budget, that we maintain as much of the earnings reserve at the Permanent Fund Corporation to be invested there rather than coming over to the general fund, and also why we took the amount from the CBR first.
Okay, so let me rephrase my question. Okay. What we'd like to know is, what's the maximum borrowing in the year you're talking about, this current year, that the general fund is subjected to?
Chair Steadman, the amount that is coming from the earnings reserve, if that is your question, is $2.7 billion in total, and approximately $1 billion of that went for the dividend funds.
No, that's not my question. It's a cash flow question. In your day-to-day operations of the state, the general fund, if it doesn't have sufficient liquidity, and it has to get its funds from someplace. Historically, we have gone to the CBR for short-term borrowing in our day-to-day operations to pay the bills and make the payroll. If we had, or I guess the reason for the question is, if we had no CBR, you had no access to the earnings reserve, you had no SBR, and you had to go to the bank, how much would you ask your banker for to pay your bills? How much cash do you need to operate the states, another way of putting it, in reserves, on set aside for you, in general terms?
Chair Steadman, this may not get to your question. I'm going to try to answer this in a way that makes sense to me. We require $400 million kind of on average, because we know and we have that we can have costs that could, if all perfect storms were to happen, we would need that much to pay our bills on any given day. We have a cash deficiency plan in place. It's an agreement between the Department of Revenue, Department of Administration, the Department of Law, and the Office of Management and Budget that dictates what should happen in times of shortages. The first line of fire is through the funds that we have, the statutory budget reserve, the constitutional budget reserve, the earnings reserve now. Then there are smaller sub-funds that are in the JFONSI that we would draw from. And then it would come to the point where we would most likely come to the legislature and say, we need help figuring this out. We have a budget. What do we pay? What do we not pay? It has never come to pass that we have gone to that final length because there have been other sources. But I think that's what would happen if that is your question. I mean,
well, it's more of a basic question. You can get back to the committee. What I want to know, if you have $400 million in cash, how much cash do you need in reserves? We have the ability here to liquidate everything. And we might have a budget that requires that. I don't think we're going to do it because it would make, you know, it wouldn't be prudent to do. There's going to be a need to have a positive CBR balance, the Constitution Budget Reserve, which is roughly about $2 billion. The question for the department is how much cash is generally borrowed through a given year to meet your liquidity needs from other accounts around the state. It could be the SBR, the CBR. It doesn't really matter to me which ones. I just want to know the dollar amounts so we can have a better idea how much cash cushion you need for operations.
Chair Stedman, I think the answer is the $400 million. It varies
come back on the record, and we'll work this out as far as the request and just a cash flow request, because we're going to have a discussion at this table on should we draw from the CBR and at what magnitude is the Finance Committee comfortable drawing from the CBR, if any, at $2 billion roughly balance left. And that's really the fundamental point of the question. We don't want to make a policy call that puts the Treasury Department in an adverse position in liquidities. And we'll work with that answer. But we'll let you continue on because we don't want to get bogged down on this liquidity point. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. You know, looking ahead here, this is just something I just want to potentially discuss. You've put together a presentation that I think is adequate but not great. And there are a lot of things that you should have added in this, and it's you're making a lot of assumptions that this committee knows what all the funds are, and your first opening statement should have been a couple slides to kind of give us a framework. My recommendation potentially is to do this over and maybe do this another time after a couple of us maybe have had a chance to kind of give you a little bit of feedback, because looking ahead at these slides, this is fine, but it's not enough, and it's not to the detail I think that this committee needs to make good decisions in the future.
All right. So we'll accelerate on through this, and we'll get some information back to you on additional information and more detail. And we are obviously concerned about the cash position of the state.
Chair Stedman.
Just hold a second. Senator Machicki.
I just have a brief question. Earlier you talked about sort of borrowing from the earnings reserve, but you don't mean that you've drawn over the percent of market value allowance. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, that's correct. We have not reached the balance of the POMV draw.
I think that was important for the public to hear as well. So,
right. And I think we need to get a finer point on some of the subjects, because if there's $2 billion in the CBR, that'd be a lot of borrowing on your day-to-day operations in that alone before you go to the permanent fund. But, Senator?
I'll yield. Thank you.
Okay. We'll go ahead and continue.
Moving on to slide number 4, the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund. In 1990, the voters of Alaska adopted an amendment to the Constitution, and that created this fund. And it truly is a savings fund, and it was created to enhance budget stability. It consists of deposits resulting from resolutions of disputes about the amount of mineral lease bonuses and royalties and taxes. And the legislature may appropriate from the Constitutional Budget Reserve to fund operations under certain conditions, as you have mentioned, primarily requires a three-quarters vote. Borrowings are allowed to fund temporary cash deficiencies, as we've also discussed, as well as budget shortfalls as appropriated by legislature. The constitutional budget reserve must be repaid when there is a surplus in the general fund at the end of the year. The subfund of the constitutional budget reserve was created in 2000 with the purpose of targeting higher returns. It had a higher risk tolerance at the time than the main constitutional budget reserve fund. In 2008, you can see on the yellow part of the graph, it was funded to make it as large as it was by a deposit of both constitutional budget main funds as well as the general fund. It was about $2.6 billion from the general fund at the time. It was liquidated in 2015 as funds were deemed to be needed within 5 years as statute required. Slide five shows the same statistics as for the Jafanzi that we saw. You can see the target asset allocation is primarily short-term as well. There is some equity that has been added to the asset allocation shortly after the subfund was moved into the main fund. Its investment objective is that it has an intermediate investment horizon and moderate risk. The balance at 12/31 was $1.7 billion, and that was after we moved $700 million out to the general fund for use to pay operating expenses. The projected 10-year return at the bottom is 2.89%, and you can see at 12/31, the actual one-year return was 0.78%. And just as an indicator that time does matter, if you had looked at the June 30 balance and the returns on a one-year rolling basis, you would have seen 1.47%. So there is certainly an impact of the markets that we've seen in the last few months.
Before you go to the next slide, just for those at home watching, the good news is I think we were looking at roughly going to the CBR for about $600 million this current fiscal year. Now it looks like maybe around $250, thereabouts, $260, some number in there, down a few hundred million. So that is good news on our potential draw of the CBR.
Moving on to slide six, you see the power cost equalization historical invested assets. This was a fund that was created in 2000 with $100 million from the Constitutional Budget Reserve. The purpose of the power cost equalization fund is essentially to provide for long-term stable financing sources for higher cost electricity service areas of the state. There was 2016, there was some legislation that changed the goal of the fund from being able to take 7% down to 5% of the monthly average market value of the last previous, I think it's three fiscal years, that could be appropriated to fund various grant programs that could be given to individuals and organizations that had high-cost electricity to offset that. The Department of Commerce is the agency that oversees the spending of the fund, and we work with them to let them know what is in the fund and what their budget appropriation the request will be. So in slide seven, you can see the statistics, the target asset allocation. There is much more equity that this fund is invested in, and that's because it is a very long-term investment horizon, and it can afford to have higher risk investments that will withstand the volatility of the equity markets over time. The projected 10-year return at the bottom is 6.2%. That's using Callan's 10-year market assumption rates. And again, if you look at the one-year actual as of December 31st, you will now see a very negative 5.63 return compared to, if you were to look at June, it would be a positive 7.5% positive return. So again, the time frame you look at returns do matter. This is a market impact that if you look at the benchmarks, you can see that the entire market felt the effects of the volatility in the marketplace. Moving on to slide 8, the Public School Trust, the historical assets are up on the screen. This is a trust that was established in 1978, and actually it replaced the territorial era public school land grant that was created by Congress in 1915. There was a permanent school trust that was created prior to 1978, and this trust was created by transfer of those assets into this investment fund. And since then, the additional revenue that comes in is from earnings, as well as 0.5% of the income from state lands, including royalty interests. Last year, there was passage of HB 213, and that changed the structure of this trust fund. It used to be a two-fund structure. There was a principal fund and an interest or income fund. And the corpus of the public school trust fund, the principal fund, had an asset allocation that did have some equity in it, and was able to provide both interest and dividends into the income fund. And that income fund was then used to offset some of the K through 12 funding, the public education funding. Its purpose is to be used for public school, and it's one of the permanent funds of the state. So after the passage of HB 213, it is now managed as one fund. You've heard the term with the Alaska Permanent Fund coming here of the percentage of market value. It is an endowment type fund, and there is a spending rule in the legislation that not more than 5% of the average market value for the 5 years preceding the last fiscal year can be spent.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Leary, as you look at this change that happened with HB 213, was that a wise move to go ahead and do at that time, to go to one fund as opposed to having two separate funds with the corpus in one and the investment returns in the other?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I believe that the former structure of the fund might be considered old school. This is more of a modern theory endowment type fund. And it also allows the fund as a whole to be managed toward and targeting riskier returns, and which will allow it to grow at a faster pace. Sure. I think in the former structure, what happened is there was more targeting of income-producing type of investments, and so there was less growth.
So you're in favor
of the fund.
Of it.
I am.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead and continue.
So here are the statistics for the Public School Trust Fund. You can see that it is a long-term investment horizon. It has high risk. There's quite a bit of equity as well. It has a similar investment now to the power cost equalization. The projected 10-year return is 6.2%. The difference between the principal fund and what it looks like now is a shift from fixed income assets into equity markets. Again, you can see the one-year actual were negative 5.66% as of December 31st, and as of June 30th, 6 months prior, that one-year return would have been a positive 6%. Slide 10 shows the historical invested assets for the defined benefit plans of the public employees retirement system as well as the teachers retirement system, both the pension and health care components. The Alaska Retirement Management Board is the fiduciary of these funds. It's a 9-person board. They meet about 5 times. Treasury staff are staff to the ARM board, and the pension plans themselves are administered by the Retirement and Benefits Division of the Department of Administration, and I believe you've had a presentation from them earlier last week. The asset allocation is set annually during the June meeting, and we'll just go right to the statistics. You can see that this target allocation has 7 different classifications for assets. And if you recall, there are numerous pools that roll up into these asset allocations. There's quite a bit of difference for these funds than the treasury funds that we manage. There's more illiquid funds that are managed because there's a very long time horizon for these funds. And that includes real assets such as real estate, farmland, timber, as well as some private equity and absolute return. The balance of these 4 funds as of 12/31 in the defined benefit pension and health trust for PERS was $16 billion, and for the teachers' plans, it was $7.9 billion. We have September returns, and those are actually now final return numbers. The slide says preliminary, but they are final. And so the 1 year actual return was 9.39% as of September 30th, and very similar for the teacher's plan. And just for other information, we have history over the 34 years that we've been tracking this information, and the returns had a nominal rate of about 9.15% over that 34-year period, which relates to a 6.52% real rate of return, which is essentially the nominal rate less inflation, so the real buying power of the fund.
Okay, we're going to have the ARM board come back at a future time, and we'll go into more detail in this along with Callan. And we have questions from Senator Von Imhoff and a question from Senator Wilikowski.
So just comparing slide 11 to slide 9, so you have the public school trust fund and then the retirement teachers. You have moderate risk, long-term investment horizon for the PERS and TERS, and you have high risk, long-term investment horizon. Just curious, the moderate risk with the slide 11 is much more diversified, has an investment return of a little bit more. Interesting, it's a little bit more, even though it's a moderate risk, which I find interesting, and they actually had much better returns. Then you look at the high risk with the Callan projected of a lower return of 6.2, much less diversified and has had tougher returns. So what would you look at this would you change the public school trust fund target allocation and potential return target to perhaps be more in line with the PERS and TERS? Is there any reason why you would do that or not do that?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, the investment objective is what you're looking at for the returns, and that has a lot of subjectivity to whether something is a moderate risk or requires high risk, et cetera. And it's really the fiduciary of the fund that determines what the risk appetite is. And so for the public school trust, it is felt that the longevity of this fund leads it to be able to have a very high risk tolerance, although the assets that are at that are available to the fiduciary of the public school trust fund do not include those that are available to the ARM board fund. So for a high risk category, the asset allocation that you see here means more movement into international equity and domestic equity. And for the retirement plans on page 11, that moderate risk level is a nod that they, the fiduciary, the ARM board, wants to moderate how much risk that they're taking, and that has to do with developing the asset allocation of each fund. There are many ways to target returns, and so how you choose and what you choose to invest your funds in is an outcome of that whole analysis and assessment of the fiduciary.
We have Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, I actually the same point. It just doesn't make sense to me that when I look at the PERS, TERS investments, moderate risk, long-term investment horizon, looks like you're doing fantastic, 8.2% return over 5 years. But then high risk and power cost equalization and public school trust fund, it's half that. When a stock market is booming and the permanent fund is returning probably over 8% during that time frame, it just doesn't make sense.
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, that I believe the higher earnings targets is a result of some of the illiquid assets that the ARM board has access to in terms of its investments. The public school trust does not currently have that as a pool in which it could participate. There are limited pools that are managed for the state assets. And that is the real reason. There are higher returns that are coming out of the illiquid markets, and I think that would be obvious if we had Callan and Associates. I believe you've requested that they come at some point with the ARM board to discuss that. You could see the breakdown of each of the assets, their rates of return, and what they contribute to the funds.
Okay. So. Excuse me, pretty much concludes the presentation today, but before you get out of the hot seat, we're going to have you invite you to come back and have more of a concentration on the general fund. And what I'm after is your cash flow. Maybe it'd be more understandable if I just ask you for a 5-year cash flow analysis, month by month. I want to know when the borrowing took place, how much, when it was paid back. That will then give us an annual, at least over the last 5 years, the annual cash borrowing needs of the general fund if you're running this $400 million balance. And it'll help us in our deliberations coming in the future. Also, I'd like to have the committee members give some thought to the ability of the Treasury Department to borrow from the permanent fund when we have $2 billion in the CBR and other funds available. I think that's a point that we need to take a further look at. I understand the need for, potential need for help from the permanent fund. And if we had a bad earthquake or a big tsunami, we shouldn't be relying, in my opinion, initially anyway, of going to the earnings reserve for day-to-day cash flow. That would just lead the legislature, I think, down the road to liquidating the CBR. And I don't think that's going to sit well at this committee when we start looking at the cash flow needs of the state. So we'll be asking you for a 5-year look back, which should give us a pretty good average of the needs, and then have that discussion here along with your prioritization of where you draw funds from. And we'll be asking why we should have as a policy access to the earnings reserve other than having them send you a check once a year for needs as appropriated by this table. I think a slippery slope when we start not addressing our fiscal issues and we start looking to the $60 billion pot any more than absolutely necessary being the permanent fund. And we will work with the Treasury Department, the two chairmen, to help with you know, what's put together, so it's understandable for the layman sitting at home watching, and it's clear to the committee how much cash needs the state has, because we're not going to miss payroll and have to go to the permanent fund, in my opinion, to make payroll. Ms. Senator Michiki.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I don't know if you have any interest in this, but I do. Just looking at the net position, I don't know how long you've been with the department, but the net position, you know, 2000 to 07, almost 08, there were times where you had nearly zero in the earnings reserve, and we plodded along with $2 billion in the CBR for years. The spending was similar toward the end of that period. I'm just curious, are we coming back to some normalcy after the years of high revenue? And I'm interested in how you manage the net position and paying our bills back then, when the total net position at time was in our savings was around $2 billion, and we were spending similarly to what we're spending today. And I realize that some of the revenue ended up being far more positive, but there were some years that were a struggle back then. Just curious how the Treasury managed that cash flow back then, now that we're coming back into some of those numbers, yet our net position is much higher because of the earnings reserve.
Right, we can have you guys take a look at that. As I recall, sitting here back when we had a couple billion in the CBR and no access to the earnings reserve, we used the CBR. And we didn't have any hiccups along the way. So it's just an area of concern that we liquidate our cash and look to the permanent fund to bail us out instead of doing the making the hard decisions, which this committee is going to do this year, next year. Because this is an unsustainable trajectory that we're on. So I thank you for coming. The Treasury Department, we are going to be your allies. We just want to make sure that we have clear information and make the best policy decisions for the people of the state going forward, and not the easy decision to get us out next summer early.
Thank you, Chair Stedman. We appreciate it, and we'll try to bring the information that you need to make those decisions.
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Next up, we have negotiated labor contracts, issues that we'll be working on here, the funding level anyway. We have the Director of Personnel and Labor Relations with us. And she's been waiting patiently with enthusiasm. She has an hour and 5 minutes. Which should be hopefully enough time. If not, we will finish her up the following day, but I think we can do it in an hour. If you can introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, give the people at home a brief synopsis of your background and how long you've been with the department, and then go on into your presentation.
All right, thank you. For the record, my name is Kate Sheehan, and I'm Director of the Division of Personnel and Labor Relations. I started in the Department of Administration in 2004 as a labor relations analyst, did that for a couple years, then went over as an assistant attorney general for a brief stint at Department of Law, then came back in 2007 to serve as deputy director over labor relations, did that for 7 years until May of 2014 when I was appointed director of the division. Today's presentation is just a little bit of a background on negotiations and then an update on all our 11 of our collective bargaining agreements. So some of this might be a repeat, but negotiations, the background of it is that in the Public Employment Relations Act, that's Alaska Statute 2340, and that provides the groundwork for what we bargain. So we must bargain wages, hours, and other terms and conditions of employment. And some of the terms and conditions of employment, there's case law that kind of describes that in a little more detail. As I said, we have 11 collective bargaining agreements. The contracts themselves kind of set forth when we begin bargaining. Contracts are not to be over 3 years in duration. Sometimes we do less than 3 years, but 3 years is the maximum allowed. So depending on the contract itself, we begin negotiations in the fall. We are required to submit the monetary terms to the legislature by the 60th day of the session. so generally mid-March. After the 60th day, they can still be submitted and they can still be considered by the legislature, but the legislature is not required to consider them if they're after the 60th day. In the past, as long as there's been a budget operating or capital, they've been put into there, but our goal and the requirement is the 60th day of session. As I stated, we do have mandatory subjects of bargaining. There's also permissive subjects of bargaining, such as classification, that we could bargain, but we are not required to. The status quo, if either side finds the demands too unfavorable, they can maintain the status quo. So when a contract expires, until we reach impasse, we just continue on with the terms of the expired contract. So I'll get to some slides coming up, and you'll see we do have several expired collective bargaining agreements that we are not at impasse, so we just continue with the status quo. Once we are at impasse, then there's a couple options for both sides. We have three classes of employees. We have class one, class two, and class three. So class one employees are our troopers, correctional officers, nurses. They are not allowed to go on strike. So if we reach impasse with them, the statute requires that we go to binding interest arbitration. Class two employees can go on strike, but the state can seek an injunction to bring them back to work. The courts look at the health, safety, and welfare to make that determination. Class two, most of our class two employees are the Alaska Marine Highway vessel employees. We also have a couple IT professionals in that field. And then the remaining employees are class three, and they can go on strike. So when impasse is reached, either by mutual agreement or the Alaska Labor Relations Agency agrees that impasse is reached, employees can go on strike, again, assuming the contract has expired, or the employer, the state, has the right to implement its last best offer. Slide number three is just kind of a broad overview of the funding and the bargaining units. And again, on my next slide, I'll get into a little more detail on the bargaining units themselves. But this slide was put together by OMB and just kind of provides the funding sources. And these accounts and costs are based on the fiscal year 19 management plan for budgeted PCNs.
Just, you know, just for the future, when you use a bunch of acronyms, it'd be nice to define them on your slide for those that aren't familiar with what they mean so they can get more meaningful data out of the slides.
Absolutely, Chair. In fact, my next slide kind of gets into a little more detail. Maybe I should have had it switched a bit.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Also in the future, it's easier when you don't include cents, because now it looks like we've got, like, you know, 18 digits here. And if you don't include the cents, it's just easier on your eye. And if everything is, you know, justified to the right, and I know I'm being nitpicky, but when you're looking at your eyes really fast to be able to see what these large numbers are, the sense really messes it up. And then having it start justified to the left, you don't see the scale as easily.
Thank you. So this next slide does get into the bargaining unit detail. And I've arranged it in order of what we're currently negotiating and then when they're coming up. So starting at the top, the Alaska Correctional Officers Association, they are Class 1 employees. Their contract did expire on June 30th, 2018. Just 2 weeks ago, we went to interest arbitration with the Correctional Officers Union. We are expecting a decision from the arbitrator March 10th, at which point then we will be required to submit the monetary terms of that arbitration award. The Alaska State Employees Association, they are our largest union. They're kind of a catch-all. There's nurses in there, engineers, paralegals, just office assistants. Their contract expires June 30th, 2019. We did reach agreement with them under the prior administration, and the terms of those agreements has been submitted to the legislature. Essentially, they agreed to cost of living adjustments of 3% in the first year, which would be effective July 1st, 2019. 1% in the second year and 1% in the third year. There's also employer contributions to their health trust. And again, I'll talk about that a little more in another slide. The Alaska Vocational Technical Center Teachers Association, those are the instructors at AVTECT. Their contract expires June 30th, 2019, and we are just now starting this week negotiations with them. The Confidential Employees Association, those are mostly my staff in the Division of Personnel and the HR staff in the agencies, as well as some finance staff in the Marine Highway Dispatchers. Their contract also expires June 30th, 2019. We did reach agreement with them under the prior administration. That agreement calls for no cost of living adjustments, but moving them to a 40-hour work week. It also includes employee contribution to health care. As you may know, for many years, employees, if they had the economy plan in Alaska Care, did not have an employee contribution, and we've started bargaining employee contributions. The next three, the Inland Boatmen's Union of the Pacific, that is our unlicensed crew. The Marine Engineers Beneficial Association, of course, that's our licensed engineers, and masters, mates, and pilots are our licensed crew. Their three contracts expired June 30th, 2017. So we've been negotiating with them since, well, the fall of 2016. We continue to meet with them. We don't tend to bargain as much in the summer because they're busy and it's hard for them to get away, but we certainly start back up again in the fall. The final one that we're currently negotiating is the Teachers Education Association of Mount Edgecombe, and of course that's the teachers at Mount Edgecombe. Their contract expired June 30th, I believe 2018. We did reach agreement with them under the prior administration, and those terms have been submitted to the legislature. They received a cost of living adjustment of 3% in the first year, 3% in the second year, and 3% in the third year. And the reason that they were a little bit higher than others is their comparators were Sitka School District, which was paying higher. And when you look at some of the negotiated wage increases, they were significantly lower than some of our other state employees.
Senator Wolakowski.
On that contract, did they agree to take on any additional burdens in terms of health insurance or anything like that?
Through the chair, Senator Wolakowski, yes. We bargained for them the same as the other unions, which is up to 12% in the first year and then up to 15% in the second, third year.
Thank you.
So should the committee assume that these increases will be in the coming budget on the 13th?
Mr. Chair, yes. It's my understanding.
Okay. Senator Muchiki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This obviously is not total number of state employees. It says bargaining unit, but you also have non-covered at the bottom. Who is missing? University? What state employees are missing from this list?
Through the chair, Senator Muchiki, there would be no university, no legislative, and no courts. This would just be executive branch.
Thank you.
Go ahead and continue.
Thank you. The next contract on there is the Public Safety Employees Association. So their contract expires on June 30th, 2020. So we will begin negotiations this fall. However, we did negotiate with them in October and November. If you may recall, there was legislative intent language to open up negotiations for troopers due to recruitment and retention issues. So the Department of Administration, we did a couple things with them. We took a classification action. We looked at a market-based pay study and determined that we were paying too low in our trooper class series. So we increased those all by one range. And that series is the trooper recruits, troopers, corporals, sergeants. We also then looked at the command staff, which is in a different union. They're in the supervisory union. But we also increased their ranges by one range. And that's the lieutenants, the captains, and the majors. In addition to the classification action, which again we don't bargain, we did bargain a cost of living adjustment of 7.5% through a letter of agreement. So the terms of that letter of agreement have been sent over to the legislature for funding and approval. The final two, the Alaska.
Second here, we got a question from Senator Wilson.
Yeah, similar to the troopers, wasn't there also a review and changes also for the nurses at API? Can you discuss that?
Yes, through the chair, Senator Wilson. We did. We also did a market-based pay study to look at nurses, and we're actually still doing a classification study on nurses, but we did increase the ranges for psychiatric nurses, so those would be at API, and there's a few at corrections. We also increased the ranges for correctional nurses, and then as a result of that, we have under the Personnel Act, classification requires internal alignment, like pay for like work is what the statute is. And so we're now looking at all the nurses as part of a larger study, including the psychiatric nurses and the correctional officer nurses.
Thank you.
Okay, go ahead and continue.
Okay, thank you. The final two is the Alaska Public Employees Association. That's our supervisors union. And Labor's Trades and Crafts, that's a maintenance, equipment operators, electricians. Those two are currently under contract, and those terms were sent last session, and both of those unions agreed to a 40-hour work week and no cost of living adjustments. The final group, the non-covered, of course, we don't bargain. They are not in the classified service. However, generally, there's been legislation if there's been any change to the state pay plan.
Okay. Was there a question?
There is, Mr. Chairman. It would be really nice to have the status on a slide for each of these units. I feverishly take notes often during these and realized you can't keep up. So the status of each of the bargaining units would be really helpful, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, we can have them come back with a modified slide. I think it would be helpful.
Yes.
Senator Bishop, then Senator Schauer.
Thank you, and the chair's latitude along Senator Machicki's line, it'd be interesting to have another page showing the previous contract for comparison with the new contract.
Okay. We can help with that historical data?
Yes, absolutely.
Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you just either talk to it here, or if there's something else you could add as well, if the chair allows? Some of the contracts seem like they're taking a long time. What is the, do we have a timetable that we have to stick to? Is that open-ended? So how does that kind of work? Because some of that, like I said, seems like it's really taking a long time.
Yes, through the chair, Senator Schauer. There is no time frame. We bargain till we reach impasse, and then again, either go to interest arbitration or there's a strike, I suppose, or an implementation of last best offer. Some of them are taking a long time. As you know, we haven't been bargaining cost of living adjustments for a while. This is the first cycle that we've done it for some of our unions. And so I think that is most definitely a sticking point. I think bargaining and employee contribution is new for many of these employees. And so that's also been a bit of a sticking point. But it has, I would say with the Marine Highway unions, it's taken quite a while.
Senator Wilkowski.
So the state is now demanding or requesting employers' contributions to health trust, to health care. And it's, I think you said 12% to 15%, and the average health care plan is around $20,000 or so. Is that about right?
Through the chair, the employer contribution right now to Alaska Care is $1,555 per employee per month. So I don't know exactly how we get, like, we're about 8% now that an employee is contributing.
You could get back to the committee on, you don't have to answer off the top of your head. We just assume you get back with accurate answers.
Okay.
We don't expect you to be an encyclopedia. So if you could get back to the committee and help Senator Wilkowski with that question, then we'll disperse the answer.
Yes.
So it's accurately reflected.
This next slide, number five, talks about the two ones we've just bargained under the previous administration and then ones that are currently under agreement. The supervisors union, as I mentioned, we did not bargain any cost of living adjustments for them. We did move to a 40-hour work week, and they do have employee contributions to the economy plan, and theirs is the same as others, up to 12% and up to 15%. With the labor's trades and crafts, again, we moved them to a 40-hour work week and no cost of living adjustments. They are in a health trust, so we don't bargain employee contributions for the health trust. We bargain the employer contribution only. And I have a slide where I can show you how much we bargained on that. And then, as I mentioned, the Alaska State Employees Association and Confidential, we entered into agreement with them in November, and those are pending for your approval. There was the cost of living adjustment for ASEA and not for Confidential, but we did move them to a 40-hour work week. This is a historical cost of living that we've done in comparison to the CPI. So you can kind of go back. I think this gives you an idea of what we look at over the years. And as I mentioned, for the teachers of Mount Edgecombe at the end there, you can see they were about at 14%, which is significantly lower than some of these. Some of the higher totals stem from groups that have access to interest arbitration, our class one employees. You can see that with the public safety and the correctional officers.
We have a question from Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So the slide is interesting because it looks at COLAs against the CPI. What would a slide might look like if we included the health care benefit the state pays, retirement, steps, things of that nature, the entire benefit package that an employee might or does get does obtain through bargaining, how might that relate to the CPI?
Well, through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, yes. So not every one of these unions has merit steps or pay increments. For instance, the three marine highway unions do not have that. The teachers are a little bit different, and AFTEC is a little bit different. But for those, the rest of the groups who have the merit and pay increments, so merit steps for the first 5 years, you are getting approximately 3.5% every year in addition to the COLAs. And then for pay increments, you are getting 3.25% every other year.
So if you could try to formulate that data to bring it back to the committee so we could see the cost of the entire package, would be helpful.
Yes.
Senator Schell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If possible, it might be helpful if we could also look at maybe, I don't know, a 20-year average of what the price, you know, since they have the data of how their pay has increased. And maybe inflation as well, just to give me kind of an idea of, or the committee an idea of how that has gone over time.
Okay, if you could possibly help the committee then with a little bit more of a historical viewpoint, mm-hmm. We'll take a look at what you send us. There's been a request for 20 years. I don't know what data you have easily available, but some look back. Here we've got, you know, a good decade plus. But if you could go back a little further.
Yes.
So we could benchmark it against inflation and other things. Because I think what the point of the question was. Correct?
Correct.
Okay, go ahead and continue.
Slide number 7 talks about benefits, about it is part of the total package. I think we've done studies with ICER over time where a lot of our entry-level pay is below market, but when you include the benefits, we're at or above market. Now, over time, we become above market, but this is for entry level. So as I mentioned, we have started bargaining employee premiums, contributions. I believe the only unions who don't have that right now are the Inland Boatmen's Union and the Marine Engineers Beneficial, and that's because we are still currently bargaining with them. We've also implemented the employee contributions for partially exempt and exempt. For health trusts, the philosophy has been to contribute at a rate which neither overfunds nor underfunds. And my next slide will show you what we are contributing to the health trusts. We have four health trusts. We have Masters, Mates, and Pilots, Public Safety Employees Association, Labor's Trades and Crafts, and the Alaska State Employees Association.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Chair Stedman. Do you ever see the financials of those health trusts to determine whether you are over or under funding? Do they allow you to see how well they are bargaining with the health care providers and saving money or not?
Yes, through the chair, Senator Von Emhoff. Yes, we, under the collective bargaining agreement, have the right to request information, and we provide information if it's requested. And then we have our consultants at Siegel do an analysis so we can make an appropriate determination of what to pay the health trust. The only trust we have a little bit of a difficulty with, the Masters, Mates, and Pilots, they're a multi-employer plan, so it's a little bit harder to get all the information we need, which also slows down bargaining a little bit, but we do have access to the information and the trust do provide it.
Do you have a number count of how many are state residents?
For Masters, Mates, and Pilots? Around
you don't have
around 70%.
Okay. You don't, again, you don't have to guess and guess wrong. We had a guy that gave us misinformation before. It didn't go well. So, Senator Von Imhoff.
So you state that you have been able to see financials from several of these health trusts to the degree to help you make decisions about how to bargain. Is that information available to legislatures as well to be able to look at? So when we're making our own allocation decisions, we can have that information as well?
Through the chair, I will need to get back on that. I know some of the information is confidential. I don't know that all of it is, but I can look into that.
Thank you. Okay. Go ahead and continue.
All right, thank you. So slide number 8, the Alaska CARES, I mentioned the employer contribution is $1,555 per employee per month. The health trusts are a little bit different. We've bargain those rates again based on our consultant at Siegel helping us make the determination. So you can see for like the Alaska State Employees Association, we're currently paying $1,432, which is less than we're paying for Alaska Care. It goes up to $1,530 and then up to $1,555. When you look at Masters, Mates, and Pilots, you can see we're currently only paying $1,346. That's the same rate we've been paying since the contract expired, so that has not gone up. For the Public Safety Employees Association, they're a little bit different. Their contract language requires us to bargain the employer contribution every year. So our actuary is looking at it every fall, and then we determine what the appropriate rate is.
Okay.
The next slides don't think I need to explain, but basically I've just put in here a bargaining unit summary for each of our 11 unions. It gives you a little bit more information about who they are, years of service, that sort of thing.
Maybe you could walk down this.
So first is, again, the Alaska Correctional Officers Association. These, the total gross pay for all members, they are actuals. And so it's based on the previous fiscal year's payroll. And so it's not necessarily what's budgeted. The bargaining members are what is actual, not budgeted PCNs. So first we have the correctional officers, the Alaska Public Employees Association. Again, these are our supervisors. They're our second largest union. And then the Alaska State Employees Association, again, they represent the general government union, and they are our largest union. Alaska Vocational Technical Teachers Association, that's the instructors at AFTECT. The confidential employees, they, as again mentioned, are the human resource type of staff who have access. And the supervisors and the confidential employees they're actually defined in regulation who is appropriately placed in those bargaining units. The Inland Boatmen's Union of the Pacific, they are our unlicensed crew, so our stewards, that type of thing. Labor's Trades and Crafts, they are equipment operators, maintenance generalists, environmental, food services, that type of electricians. Marine Engineers Beneficial Association, they are licensed engineers on board the vessels. Masters, Mates, and Pilots are a licensed crew.
I see Masters, Mates, and Pilots have a longer, average years of service is 12.8. A lot of these are around 8 years, 8 to 9 years, so they definitely hang around longer. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair. They're highly skilled. It takes them quite a while to get pilotage for some of the routes they do, so they tend to stay on longer. The Public Safety Employees Association, they represent not just the troopers, but also airport police and fire, court service officers, and fire marshals. So you will see the 7.5% cost of living adjustment that is pending with the legislature right now. That was just the troopers. It wasn't all of public safety employees. The Teachers Association of Mount Edgecombe, again, those are the teachers. Not all the staff at Mount Edgecombe, just the teachers. The staff would be in the general government union. And then the last two slides is just some information I talked about earlier. It's about the three strike classes defined. And then the final slide shows what happens if either the union fails to ratify the terms of the collective bargaining agreement or the legislature does not approve. Most of the contracts do require that we immediately re-enter negotiations.
And could you go over again the 60-day rule?
Yes. Under statute, we are required to submit the monetary terms to the legislature by the 60th day of session. If we've agreed to it outside of session, we have to have it 10 days submitted, 10 days after the beginning of session. But for most of our collective bargaining agreements, we're still in the process of bargaining. So if the Department of Administration submits it later than the 60th day, the legislature does not have to consider it, but they can.
Have the legislature ever not funded?
Yes, they have not funded before.
And if you could give us the history on that when you get back to the committee, it'd be nice to know.
Yes, I can do that.
I don't recall in my tenure that we ever didn't fund it, but we'll take a look at that so we have a kind of the history. Do we have other questions for the presenter? Or we let her off the hook and never come back with more data? Seeing none, I'd like to thank you for coming before Senate Finance today and going over this. It was interesting in your slides to see the years of service and the average age are fairly close on all of the bargaining units in the mid-40s in age and 8 to 9 years of average service across the board. So that'll conclude our meeting today. Our next meeting will be tomorrow, 9 a.m. We're going to have a consideration of Lieutenant Governor's successor appointee, Mr. Johnson, Commissioner of Education and Early Development. So we'll have that discussion at the table tomorrow, 9 a.m. sharp. Thanks, everybody, for coming. We are adjourned.